Chairman, would you be willing to host a CODEL, a congressional delegation, in the CHAZ so that we might all be able to go there and show the country what's happening, observe it in real time, and then if the CHAZ is something that the majority would like to have spread across the country, perhaps you can make that case in vivid color, but I'll yield to the chairman to answer whether or not he'd be willing to lead the CODEL to the CHAZ.
Lead the CODEL to the CHAZ. This is the Sarah Carter Show. Yes. Yes, Congressman Matt Gaetz, the best question of the week. And it goes to the congressman from the great state of Florida. Oh, by the way, we have another great congressman from the state of Florida coming on later on the show to talk about all of the insanity across our country, particularly dealing with law enforcement and police officers and the very real issues, by the way, that we all as a nation have to understand and debate. You know, excessive use of force, the protection of law enforcement officers who are out there every day sacrificing and putting their lives on the line to protect our communities. What can we best do? And what is happening in Congress, folks? What is happening with these bills that are targeting law enforcement officers across the country? Are we solving a problem or are we making a crisis worse? That is going to be Congressman Greg Stube from the great state of Florida. He will be with us. Again, it's an important topic. It's something we need to talk about. And I don't think there's anybody better. Look, Greg has been a warrior for individual liberties. He's fought to defend our constitutional rights. He's served in the U.S. military as a JAG officer. He presently serves in the House Judiciary Oversight Reform Committee and Veterans Affairs Committees. So this is a man that really understands. He knows what he's talking about, and he's going to be able to lay everything out for us clearly. But I want to get back to the CHAZ. I want to get back to the CHAZ because I want to be on that CODEL. I will go to Seattle. I will put my boots on, my rubber boots. I will walk through the CHAZ, the six blocks of what I have seen is not so pretty CHAZ situation happening in the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, where basically there are no cops. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. People are like, you know, out on the streets to the point where there are some people defecating on the sidewalks. This is just insane. And there's nobody there. And there's nobody there to stop people that are starting up, you know, fighting with others. Somebody stole somebody's keys from the car the other day. There's been fights in the street. For the most part, peaceful, but a mess. But a mess. Six blocks of mess in Seattle, and it's really sad. And I'm sure it's smelly. I'm sure there's issues. I'm sure the CHAZ is not a pleasant place to hang out or vacation to. But Congressman Gaetz brings up a really good point. Brings up a point, right? If Nadler, you know, Chairman Nadler and all of these folks that support the CHAZ, support these zones and want to do something with these zones, well, they should get out there and take a look for themselves. They should have a tour, listen to their constituents, see what Chazians want done. I like that, Chazians. The Chazians almost sounds kind of alien-like, right, Adam? It's kind of like a new form of human, a Chazian.
I've already called.
Or maybe a new country.
I've already called Webster's Dictionary. We're coining that.
We're coining Webster's Dictionary, Chazians. The Chazians abound. And, you know, honestly, Matt Gaetz and I are just full disclosure. Congressman Gaetz is a good friend. He's a great guy. He's been on the show before, and he does have a podcast. It's called Hot Takes with Matt Gaetz. And I'm just going to throw it out there for him because he would appreciate me doing that, one friend to another. Now I'm going to listen to your show, Congressman Gaetz, and see if you throw out something for the Sarah Carter Show, right? That's what I expect next time I hear this. So for all of you at home who are thinking about, you know, what does this mean? Capitol Hill autonomous zones, for all of us who are still working or in a semi-lockdown or in a phase two, phase three, phase one of our lockdowns, I have no idea because it's the whole coronavirus, COVID-19 mess is still there. Apparently, it's still there. Oh, this is funny. I got to talk about this really quick because this is great. And Jenny wrote a story on SarahCarter.com about this. This is about Dr. Fauci. So he was basically asked on CNN, do you think, you know, we're going to have football season this year? You know, people out there just want some sports. They just want some camaraderie. They just wanted things to get back to normal. And Fauci, wow, he just killed it. He just destroyed all hope for football, for sports. He says, unless they can be in a bubble, nobody will be safe. Jenny, I got to bring you on. I don't know if you can hear me now, but I want to bring you on because Jenny just got back from Houston. She is now in Washington, D.C. She left Normalville for Strangeville. And the bubble really is Washington, D.C. I don't know if the bubble's around actually the football players, but we have a bubble in D.C. that's crazy, and nobody in this bubble ever listens to anybody outside of the bubble. But Jenny's back in the bubble here. Jenny, you wrote about Fauci's bubble comment. What do you think's happening there? How do you think people are going to respond to this?
I don't think people are happy with this. And you can see that people are, you know, increasingly like leaving their homes and opening their businesses, you know, despite different orders from local governments, and because they have to, it's their livelihood. And it's so scary to think about. But, you know, I was listening to Joe Rogan's podcast the other day.
Love it. Love him.
You know, basically what's going to happen here is if things don't open up, we're just going to hand over the economy to these monopolies like Amazon, and small businesses will just be a thing of the past. And this is just part of that.
Yeah. Adam, what do you have to say? Because I know you like me, we have small businesses. We care about this. This is a very important issue close to our heart.
Sure. No, I do. I certainly do. I just wanted to throw it out there that what Fauci said is that he really needed them to model it after the NBA. And what you're seeing right now, because the NBA is going after a bubble plan down in Orlando at Disney compound, where they have all of these, like, it's a huge complex where you usually have all these, like, national tournaments. But anyway, the problem is that a lot of these players are seeing now what it's going to take to do this NBA bubble, and they're having a lot of regret and a lot of second thoughts. So Fauci is now saying you're going to need to either do it like that, NFL, or not at all. And I don't see the NFL having it.
Yeah, I don't see the NFL doing that either. And who knows? I don't see them having it either. I mean, this is huge amounts of money too, right? Athletes getting prepared for the season. I mean, what do they do? How do they train? How do they stay? I mean, when do they get back if they cut, right? When do they get back? When do they get back? Until we find a vaccine? Who knows? But I, you know, for all of you out there who are dealing with this, I mean, this isn't just, I mean, I'm bringing up football, but this is all of us. We are all in our homes. We are learning to get back to some kind of normalcy. Now we're being told possibility of a second wave. No, there's not going to be a lockdown if there is a second wave. Wait, there will be a lockdown if there is a second wave. Again, confusion across the land, confusion around the globe. And by the way, there are people who have been literally affected and have died from this virus. It's tragic. It's sad. We want to protect everyone, but we're also asking a lot of questions, and we got to ask those questions. What does it mean to wear a mask? Are we really protecting ourselves from COVID-19? You know, the World Health Organization came out just last week, folks, and I'm sure you all saw that, and said, you know, it's not really that contagious from asymptomatic people to someone else. Like, that means somebody who maybe has the virus but isn't showing any symptoms can't really, it's very rare, can't pass it on. And then all of a sudden, a day later, 2 days later, it was like, oh, whoa, back up the train. Maybe it is. It could be based on models up to 40%. It's very confusing. And it's really hard as an American or as anyone around the globe, but especially here in the United States of America with all the freedoms and our jobs and job losses and hopefully jobs gained, to plan, to decide, how do we move forward? What do we do with our children? What happens in the fall? You know, if there is another outbreak of the virus, and are we going to keep our kids home? Is anyone going to give us an idea of what we need to prepare for? Because, you know, if they just throw it on us again, if our children are once again at home with us, that changes the whole dynamic again, right? Changes everything for us. Because what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We have to teach them. They have to be at home. We got to go back to work. usually in the United States, it's almost always both people in the household. And what if you're a single parent, have a job? This is tough. These are tough decisions and something that we really, really need to think about. I want to go straight into what's been happening, though, with the riots, guys. I mean, this is, you know, from the rioting and the protests across the nation to the autonomous zones to what's happening with our law enforcement officers right now. There is a lot of issues that we've been dealing with, and I'm going to bring up a couple of those, and some of them, you know, really quite sensitive issues, because there are people that feel genuinely afraid in some places, and I'm not going to take that away from them. They come from communities that are underprivileged. They don't have a lot of access to the same things others have, legal, you know, attorneys or good schools or good communities. It's different for them. Life is different. And, you know, people have made that loud and clear. I know that there are communities that are underprivileged. I grew up in one of them for a while. That was my life when I came back from Saudi Arabia, right? Single mom working in a factory, working in a pretty much low middle class urban environment neighborhood east of LA, right? Gang members. I know it's not easy. It's tough. It's tough. But we have to be realistic too. We can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. You can't just expect to defund all of our police officers, our police stations, change them, transform them, make them social welfare offices, you know, remove funding from. And also, let's talk about our law enforcement officers' concerns, too. Because a lot of them aren't paid very much. There are some areas where police officers are making $32,000 a year, you know, $33,000 a year to start. And they put a lot on the line, and they're out there every single day, and they're every color from every place with every background and every religious belief. There are Muslim police officers and Christian officers and Buddhist officers. And I don't know, there's probably, and Hindu. I mean, we're probably run the whole gamut, right? And every color. And so they're all out there doing their job. But if all of a sudden they feel like as what happened in Atlanta, because we don't have a lot of the answers yet as to what happened in Atlanta with that shooting. And I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of issues, because right now, and I'm going to, you know, go through some of this, you know, there's a belief that Rayshard Brooks right now, based on some video and audio, that when he tussled with the two Atlanta police officers and he grabbed the taser and then ran off, that he actually turned and hit one of the police officers with the taser. According to the police officer's attorney, that police officer fell to the ground. He fell to the ground and had a concussion. And so, you know, remember, everybody came out, because this happened after George Floyd. Tensions are high. People are anxious. We've already been dealing with not just the protests and the riots and George Floyd's death, but being locked down because of COVID. And tensions are high, and people march. They burn down the Wendy's where this took place. But now they're going to charge these officers, possibly, especially the officer that shot Rayshard Brooks in the back, with a felony murder charges. Now, it was just immediate. The prosecutors came in. They're going to charge him with felony murder. The Atlanta police officers, some of them are calling in sick in some of the zones. They're just calling in sick. They're not showing up. I'm going to tell you, I saw this happen. I saw this happen on the U.S.-Mexico border when Border Patrol agents started to get charged because illegal immigrants were accusing them of everything. And they couldn't even defend themselves. They were just like, especially when the political winds blew against their direction, like when there would be one bad apple. And all of a sudden, the entire price would be paid. So guess what happens? Police officers stop doing their work. They're not going to put they're human. They're not going to put their lives on the line, go into the worst area, worst neighborhoods in, you know, in our urban cities, even though they want to. and try to save people's lives when the fear is that they get in an altercation with somebody, if somebody goes after them, if they panic, if anything happens, even with all their training, that they are going to be charged with felony murder before they even get a chance for a fair review of their case. And now we see some video, you know, that Rayshard Brooks, look, I'm not saying that what happened was right or wrong right now. I'm saying that we don't know in the case of Atlanta. What happened to George Floyd was horrific. It was tragic. It was wrong. It was horrific. Should have never happened. But we don't have all the facts in Rayshard Brooks' case. You know, when you roll around on the ground and grab a weapon off of a police officer, it's not going to end well at all, no matter what. Not even if shots are fired or not. It's not going to end well at all. I mean, you got to know that. You just can't do it. But we got to wait for the facts to come out. And, you know, this is why I wanted to talk to Congressman Stubbe today, because he's going to be able to lay it out. He's going to be able to tell us what is happening. You and I both need to know this. We both need to know what's going on in Congress, how right now with the House, definitely the Democrats, they passed the bill, right? Which is going to impede and push officers to the limit. I'm telling you right now, that's what they're saying. But what's going to happen once it goes to the Senate? And we're going to be talking to Congressman Stubbe about that right now. Congressman Stubbe, thanks so much for being on the Sarah Carter Show. I'm glad you are back in Florida and going to enjoy some of that sun over there and getting out of the bubble of Washington, D.C.
Yes, nice to be back in Florida and out of the swamp. That's for sure.
Everyone says that. Do you really think we're ever going to drain this swamp? I just want a quick yes or no.
I think you can. I just think it's going to take a really long time because you have so many Democratic bureaucrats in the deep state that have been there for decades, and it's very hard to pull those out in one administration.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I know it's going to take years. You're right. It's going to take years. I think the president has been doing a great job of doing that now over the last few years. But I think there's still so much more that needs to be done. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit before we go into the police reform bills. It's so important. And I know this is an important topic for me and for everyone else out there. But you served our country. You're a veteran. You were a JAG in the Army. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, when I was in my first semester of law school is when September 11th occurred. And my family has a background in law enforcement, and my grandfather served in World War II, but my father and brother served in law enforcement, not in the military. So I never really had a military aspiration until we were attacked on September 11th. And I just felt a calling to serve my country. I felt like it was our generation's time to serve, and we had been attacked. I had guys in law school that were in the reserves that were getting called up, and I'm like, look, I'm able-bodied. I'm able to do this. I should do my part and serve my country. So I actually graduated law school early, went in, I enlisted. I went in as an infantryman, went in as an E-4.
Wow.
A direct commission, but I wanted to do the infantry stuff and spent about a year and a half in the infantry. I got hurt in Ranger school and decided, because I was already a lawyer by practice, I would just transfer from the infantry branch to the JAG Corps. Well, when you get into the JAG Corps as an former infantry officer, you are a rare commodity in the JAG Corps. So they want to put you in a place where you would be most useful, which would obviously be an infantry division. So when I got out of JAG school after serving the infantry for a period of time, I was assigned with the 25th Infantry Division. And then when I got there, it was the same kind of thing. Like, we have a prior combat arms type trained individual who would be great for the chief of detainee operations. So I was actually the chief of detainee operations for Multinational Division North when I deployed to Iraq, because the 25th Infantry Division was the headquarters element in that MND in northern Iraq. So,
wow, that's so incredible. I want our listeners out there to really understand, explain that job, because I've been in Iraq. I've been in Afghanistan. I covered the war, and my husband's military. He's Army as well, retired Delta. But your job is so was so significant. And the fact that you saw both sides, both infantry and the legal side, makes you perfect for the show today and talking about these police reform bills. But explain your job there so that everyone out there understands what you did. I mean, this is really incredible.
Well, anything at that point in time, anything with the word detainee in it kind of came to my desk. But there was a team of us. We had a detainee operations team, and there was only three of us. I was the legal rep. We had a MI guy who did all the intel stuff. And then I had an MP, which was your military police. And we decided what happened with the detainees that were captured in our MND. So we had four brigade combat teams underneath the headquarters element, and each brigade combat team that would capture a detainee would send us a packet. I would look at it, obviously, from a legal perspective. And there, I came after Abu Ghraib occurred. So I was in country 06 to 07. So there was just a litany of DOD and Department of Army policy on how you treated detainees. So not only did we decide the direction that we prosecuted these individuals, but I also inspected detention facilities. I monitored and was involved in interrogations. I did a lot of different things that not only training our soldiers how to treat detainees, but deciding what we did with them during that period of time.
That's incredible. And that is a really, really tough job in a really tough time period. And now you see what's happening here in the United States. I mean, and I'm going to bring you back. I hope you come back on this show again to talk about Afghanistan and Iraq, because I'd love to get your thoughts on that. But I want to talk about the national crisis. And I think what you've been through in your life, and also the legal issues that you've had to deal with for both in the military and seeing and that your family was also in law enforcement, your father and your brother. And you're seeing what's happening now with our police and law enforcement because of the ramifications after George Floyd. What do you think is going on here? How do you think this is going to change our country if we can't come to some kind of compromise that satisfies both sides?
Well, it is frustrating to me, from somebody that's always supported law enforcement, what's happening. And I think what happened to George Floyd should never have happened.
Right.
You have an individual laying on the ground that's handcuffed, and you're going to continue to keep your knee on his neck while he's saying he can't breathe. To me, that's inexcusable, and that shouldn't happen. But to punish all law enforcement officers with a broad brush because of the actions of one individual is completely wrong. And I think what a lot of people aren't talking about is, how did that officer in that department get to where they are? All of these departments that have had all of these problems and all of these issues are all run by Democratic commissions and Democratic city councils who have been beholden to the police unions. None of them are accredited agencies. None of them are using training protocols that the agencies in my departments in my district use. And so they're using training protocols from 20 years ago because the unions have pushed on the Democratic leadership saying, oh, we don't want new training protocols. That's not going to work. So in the Minneapolis training protocol, and I read an article that laid out the specific section, a person on the force can actually use a neck restraint on somebody who's resisting arrest. Well, that's not where we should be in our country right now. And they're there in these different places, in Atlanta, in Minneapolis, in New York, in Chicago, because of the leadership that they've had, who have failed to take on their city police offices and ensure that they're using the most up-to-date standings and protocol, using the best training, and that the officers are getting the training that they should be getting in these different municipalities.
Well, it's like they're under the thumb of these unions. And then you have Congress, which exacerbates it. So you have the Democrats in Congress. They're exacerbating the crisis, right? And a lot of special interest groups out there that are all benefiting from extending this crisis and pushing it on. And the people that are going to pay for it really are the citizens of this country in urban communities where there is high crime, as well as law enforcement officers who really are. I mean, I've been talking to the congressmen. Some of them are saying, look, even in ICE and Border Patrol, I just want another job. I want to get out of this. I don't want to go out and patrol. I'm terrified that I'm going to end up like these officers in Atlanta, or that I'm going to end up in an altercation that's going to go bad for me. Can you talk to us about the bill that just got out of the House and why those officers may have a right to be concerned?
Well, they absolutely have a right to be concerned. And I'll just tell you real quick, my brother's still on the force in Manatee County, Florida, which isn't in my district, but it's just north of my district, just a couple of miles away. He's been on the force for 20 years. He served on the SWAT team for 10 years. And I talked with him last week, and he said, he's a supervisor. I've had two people in my unit already quit, and he only has 5 more years left. And if he only had a few years in, I can guarantee you he would be out. But because he has 20 years in, he's going to do his 5 remaining years to get his retirement, and he's gone. So the impact this has had on our officers whose patrol cars are getting looted, who are being targeted. There was an officer, and you'll never hear about this in the mainstream media, an African-American officer who worked for the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission in Florida, just south of my district, was killed this past weekend. His funeral is on Monday. I talked about it in the hearing yesterday. He was off duty responding to a hit and run. The moment I talked to the officer in the department who's been investigating it, the moment that the African-American officer who was in plain clothes told the bad guy that, hey, stop, I'm a police officer, you have to stop what you're doing, the bad guy pulled out a gun and shot and killed him. Prior to there was no threat. So he was intentionally killed because he was an officer and identified himself as an officer. That's what's going on in our communities in the state because of the left media perpetuating all of these things because they think it benefits their mantra and their narrative, and they would love nothing more than to create chaos. And what you're going to have is a lot of really, really good people who want to serve their communities and their country and law enforcement who are just not going to do it. And that's bringing it to the bill that we talked about yesterday that passed. There are so many things in there that I can talk about, and I'll talk about qualified immunity first. If you take that out, If no longer officers know that if I am operating within my training and protocol and I am doing what I have been trained to do in apprehending a suspect, that I am going to be protected under the law. If you take that away from them, why would you go and arrest those people? My brother was telling me there was 30 people that looted a Walmart near my district and they only had 3 officers respond. Well, what do you think they did? They're not going to send 3 officers in with 30 kids. They just let them go. Because my brother and other supervisors are not going to put their officers in a scenario where something like this can occur and they're going to get hurt or they're going to get attacked. And then if they respond under their trainings and protocol, they're going to be, you know, fired immediately if they react in a way that they should react under their training. It's
right.
It's that a place we're in our country right now.
Well, and this is what's so concerning to me, Congressman, because I always say this every time I do this podcast. I hear it from listeners. I hear it on Twitter and in emails, you know, from officers as well as from regular citizens, people that basically are normal folks. They're not going to go out to the Chaz. They're not going to riot. They're not going to loot. They're not going to burn. But they feel like their voices have been silenced. They feel like they don't know how to respond because they really are terrified of these changes that are happening in the country. And they don't, I think they just need some leadership or they want someone to stand up. So how can the Republicans, especially in the House, I mean, you're one of them. I know there are a lot of others out there that are speaking up, but kind of do both, balance out the needs of the law enforcement officers and the citizens who are ultimately going to pay the biggest price if our law enforcement system fails.
Well, and I think the mass majority of people, probably if you did a poll in my district, it's probably 85-90% of people support our law enforcement and want to ensure that they have the tools that they need to do their job effectively. And so I think as elected officials, and I have been doing that, yet you'll never hear about me thanking this officer who died, an African-American officer who died near my district serving his state and his community. You'll never hear about that in the mainstream news, that an African-American officer was killed once they found out that he was actually a cop. So I think talking about those things, telling law enforcement that we support them, filing the amendments that I filed yesterday on the bill that are the things that I had at a round table with all of my sheriffs. I represent 9 counties in Florida, and I had a round table the day before the hearing just to hear from them what type. I sent them the bill as soon as the language came out, let them look it over. What were their specific problems? What were their specific objections? So that I could tailor my amendments based on the feedback that I'm getting from the law enforcement leaders in our community. And how, if this bill currently drafted by the Democrats, if this were to become law, how hard it would be for law enforcement officers to do their job.
Explain why. Explain the areas of the bill that will make it difficult for a law enforcement officer to do their job if this House bill passes.
I'll talk about the top three or four, in my opinion. The first one I already kind of hit on is the qualified immunity piece. And just so people understand, it's not immunity from lawsuits and from criminal acts that you do outside of your training and protocol. It doesn't cover that. So the officer that killed George Floyd, this isn't, qualified immunity is not going to attach to him because he went outside of the training and protocol. It's for an officer that is responding to an escalation of force and he follows his training and his protocols and his general operating procedures and his standard orders that are in his department. If he does that, then he's going to be immune from civil lawsuit from whoever it was that he was trying to detain because he followed his training.
That's right. So like a criminal could sue an officer if they feel that maybe in the pursuit of that criminal, they had been injured or they felt manhandled by the officer, any reason whatsoever, right? They could then turn around and sue the officer.
Absolutely, 100%. And you will see every criminal defendant do that if you take this immunity away. And they will, and then law enforcement officers who are making $35,000 to $50,000 a year protecting us don't have the money to hire lawyers to defend them in these cases. So you're going to see person after person say, you know what? I'm not going to put myself in this circumstance or my family in this circumstance for $50,000 a year when I did everything that I was supposed to do and the two bad guys beat each other up and then said that I went outside of my training and protocol and that you can sue regardless of whatever evidence you have there. And then you have to deal with a lawsuit. If you take that away, I think that's one of the most offensive things that's going to definitely affect law enforcement.
And the others?
So the second one I filed amendment on to take out too was banning no-knock warrants in drug-related cases. And I
right, total agreement with you on this.
Explain. Well, and I encourage people to watch my presentation of this amendment because I used a visual aid. In Florida, we have had a fentanyl and opioid epidemic, and we have drug dealers here that are splicing heroin with fentanyl, and just a little tiny piece of fentanyl can kill you. There was a drug bust a year ago in Brevard County. They seized 3 pounds of fentanyl. 3 pounds of fentanyl is enough fentanyl to kill 500,000 people. And I used an illustration in the committee. I had two Yeti cups. And I said, these two Yeti cups hold 60 ounces of, they hold 60 ounces. 3 pounds is 48 ounces. So if you took 3 pounds of fentanyl and poured it into these two cups and you banned no-knock warrants, i.e., I'm going to have to go and knock on the drug dealer's house and let him know I'm law enforcement. I'm coming in and going to exercise a search warrant. What do you think he's going to do with those two Yeti cups of fentanyl? He's going to flush them down the toilet or he's going to dump them down the sink before law enforcement can get in. And the whole purpose of a drug search warrant is to get the bad guy with the drugs. If he flushes them down the toilet, you can't charge the guy with possession of drugs because they're not there anymore. It would be hugely disastrous in drug cases, and in Florida, where we have 17 people a day dying from drug overdoses because of heroin and fentanyl and opioids, it would be monstrously disastrous on things where we're trying to execute search warrants on drug dealers who are killing people in Florida every single day.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's absolutely ridiculous, and but it is part of that bill. And then what is the other one? You said you had three top.
Yeah,
and by the way, I want everybody, we're going to put that up on the website at sarahacarter.com. We are going to post the clip of your statement in Congress with the Yeti cups. We're going to put that up there so that everyone out there who's listening to Congressman Stuby right now, you can go on our site and we will have that up so you can see it and see the hearing.
Well, and it's just a great visual of how easy it would be for a drug dealer if the cops were forced to knock before they executed a search warrant, how easy it would be to dump that down a toilet and flush it or down a sink. The other thing that is most offensive to me, having a family in law enforcement and then serving in the military, is the left's characterization of the militarization of our police force. So in this bill, the Democrats have said that no longer will law enforcement agencies be able to receive military equipment, firearms, protective equipment, silencers. Well, in my opinion, being a person that's a strong proponent of the Second Amendment, that is a small step that the Democrats are taking to, hey, if we take up semi-automatic rifles from our law enforcement officers and ban them, the militarization, quote unquote, of our police force. Well, if we ban them from the cops from being able to use them, then guess who's next? Your AR-15s and your semi-automatic weapons are going to be confiscated as well, because if the cops can't have them, you can't have them. But the biggest piece of that is all, and I talked to my sheriffs about this, they get their ballistic vests, their protective shields, armored vehicles to execute search warrants on. They get all of this from the military.
Right. And I want to bring this up, and I want to ask your opinion on this. What do you think about the fact that the gang members, the drug cartels, criminals have some of this type of extensive equipment, high-end equipment anyways? How are our police officers, and by the way, our federal agents, our Border Patrol agents, our ICE agents, I talked to the sheriffs along the U.S.-Mexico border, and I've covered that area for a long time, that have said, look, the drug cartels have so much more than we have. I mean, we are so unmatched to them. It is so tough to fight them, because even with technology, even high-tech technology to intercept phone calls, drones, as well as weapons. So when our officers are limited, aren't we giving the drug cartels, the gang members, the drug dealers, and other criminals a lot more leeway?
Absolutely. And the amendment after, so my amendment took out all of the militarization language and still would allow law enforcement agencies to get that type of equipment. Congressman Gates, after that, did a narrow amendment that would just continue to allow our Border Patrol, to your point, to be able to continue to get this equipment, because the drug cartels have rocket launchers and drones that can drop things and all this equipment that they use to attack our Border Patrol agents on. So you would think at least the Democrats would be okay with our Border Patrol agents having that equipment. And I urge your listeners to go listen to what Jerry Nadler said as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, basically saying none of our officers should have this type of equipment. It's a scary place that we are in. If just those three things occur, of the protection of our law enforcement and their ability to protect our communities and their abilities to do their job.
You know what? I couldn't agree with you more, Congressman. I mean, it's a really frightening concept. It's really hard to believe that that could actually happen to our country. I wanted to ask your opinion on what was happening in New York, like with taking out plainclothes units. I mean, just based on the fact that your family is in law enforcement, I don't know if your brother or your father, if you had a chance to talk to them about this, but what do you think about that? That some Democrats are pushing to take out in their local law and police, police departments, plainclothes units that would be targeting drug dealers, that would be targeting, as undercover cops, type of criminal elements.
Yeah, I mean, again, you're having a Democratic-led department by their Democratic leadership making a decision to make it harder on their law enforcement officers to do their job, instead of giving them the resources they need to be successful, giving them the people that they need to be successful to do their job. What you end up happening is what you saw yesterday in Atlanta, is you're gonna have officers start to call in and not come to work. You're gonna have people quit, like what happened in my brother's department. You're gonna see this all across the country, where officers who have a family are gonna just say, you know what? My wife wants me to come home, my two little girls want me to come home. My children want me to come home. It is not worth somebody breaking into my car every day, being spit on, yelled at, attacked, targeted by these extremist organizations that the left continue to perpetuate at the sake of the lives of our law enforcement officers.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you, what do you think needs to be done then? If you had a chance to talk with President Trump, if you had a chance to be able to put the perfect package together, what would that be for you?
Well, the first thing is part of what the executive order did, but I think Congress needs to do it so it's law and it's not just, you know, through the executive branch, is making sure that bad cops don't get hired at other agencies. And I was talking to my father, who served over 40 years in the same department. He was the sheriff for several terms, and said that would be a good step, because what happens is, you know, because of trial lawyers and liability and all that, if the next hiring department calls you about an officer that was quote unquote released or resigned, you're not allowed to give that information as to why he resigned, because you might be sued by that individual for telling them why he left the department. So having a national database that when an officer is either resigns or removed, that his disciplinary chart and action and file is put into a database so that that officer can't go down the road to the local police department after leaving the sheriff's department and get hired, I think that would go a long way to ensure that good cops are out there doing their job. And if there are bad cops that aren't doing the things that they shouldn't be doing, don't get rehired either in a different state or a different agency. And that was included in the president's executive order and is one of the pieces of the Republicans' bill that we made public today.
I think that's I think that is truly one of the most important pieces. And do you think that once this reaches the Senate, I mean, what are you hoping? What do you foresee? Do you foresee that the Senate will allow this House bill to move forward? Do you think there's going to be anyone caving in on that on the Republican side? Or what do you think is going to happen as a result of all of this?
I don't see, and maybe there will be some, you know, I can't speak for the almost 200, if a little bit more, 200 members in the Republican caucus. Every Republican voted against the Democrats' bill yesterday in committee. I don't see many Republicans voting on the bill in its current form, and I don't see the Democrats changing it before it passes the House floor. I know that Mitch McConnell would like to bring up Tim Scott's bill in the Senate, but in the reports that I've seen, the Democrats now on the Senate side are trying to weigh what to do with that, because obviously they don't want to be seen as being against some of the things that are in that bill. So if they can get to 60 votes in the Senate with Senator Scott's bill, I believe they'll send that to the House. And then I don't know if they'll put a conference committee together to kind of hash out some of the differences, or if the House will just take the Senate bill and send it to the president. I think something's going to get done, but if Tim Scott's bill doesn't get 60 votes and they need, what, 7 Democrats to
right.
vote that bill in the Senate, if they don't get those votes in the Senate, I don't think it goes anywhere, because the House bill certainly won't be picked up by the Senate.
So we're definitely possibly seeing some type of stalemate before any decision is actually made. And you brought up Tim Scott, so I'm just going to ask you, Senator Tim Scott really hit back at Dick Durbin for using the word token to basically criticize him. And, you know, it's so frustrating. Here's, you know, this incredible senator has so much to offer. And, you know, he points out, look, at this is what the Democrats are doing. This is what they're calling me a token, because I want, you know, how does that come across? I mean, I know Dick Durbin apologized to him, but do you see this as always two-sided? Democrats are always getting away with something that a Republican would never, you know, it just would never happen.
Oh, absolutely. And even an African-American Republican senator in the United States Senate, I think he absolutely was plenty able to respond to what Dick Durbin said. And I think it's appropriate. What's interesting is if you go back and watch the hearing from last night, and I'm sure your listeners don't want to listen to 12 hours of going back and forth, but race was brought up so much. And the African-American Democrats, brought everything with them was race. And I think that is extremely dangerous for our country, because you are further dividing us based on the color of our skin. And that is racism. And that is not what we should be talking about. If there are issues at the federal level that we can fix, then we need to be focused on that and put the race discussion to the side. It needs to be about what we can do to ensure that our law enforcement officers are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Our departments have the tools that they need. As soon as you start instigating race, you're further dividing our country at a time where we don't need to be further divided. We need to be talking about solutions and not dividing our country.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Congressman. Thank you for giving me so much of your time. I feel enlightened by talking to you, and I would hope that you come back on the show. I know that the listeners out there, I know you all feel the same way. I really feel that you laid it out for us so that we can understand what's going on with this bill, this law enforcement reform bill, and I just hope, like you said, that we can all see each other as Americans and not as races and colors and, you know, various religions. We're all Americans. My husband, you fought overseas against a common enemy, and color didn't matter when that was the case. Right. We're all one people. We're Americans. And so if we look at it that way, we can find common solutions. And that I do believe.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show and be happy to come back.
We are all Americans. We come from all different parts of the world. We have different cultures, different backgrounds, but we're all Americans. We love our nation. We love our country, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. That's what's important here. We fight for that. We fight for that. You know, just like Congressman Stubbe fought in Iraq, right? And was in the army, just like my husband fought overseas and spent more than 30 years of his life, you know, defending our country. We fight for those freedoms. It doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't matter what religion you are. I keep trying to say that over and over again. It does matter that some people target other people because of the color of their skin. That is wrong. And that needs to stop. But we can't be so divided that we can't find any common ground. It's interesting. I hope I didn't remove that. No, I did not. It's here on my phone, Jenny and Adam and everyone else out there. It's Burgess Owens. He is running for Congress in Utah. And he has this tweet that I think is so important. It goes right to what Congressman Stubbe says. And he said, there was a time when liberals and conservatives could talk through ideas. We've lost the ability to debate through concepts. It's become, if you don't agree with this, you're a racist. And that kind of intolerance is dangerous, not just for our culture, but for our future. Burgess Owens is 100% right. He is 100% right. And I want you to hear, here is Senator Tim Scott. And this is after he gets called a token by Dick Durbin, a Democrat. Senator Tim Scott is African-American Republican. I want you to hear this.
The senator from Illinois referred to this process, this bill, this opportunity to restore hope and confidence and trust from the American people, from African-Americans, from communities of color, to call this a token process. Hurts my soul. For my country, for our people.
It hurts my soul. It hurts for my country. It hurts for our people, the American people. And I want you all to think about that when you go out, just like me, to the grocery store or walk down the street or go for a run or take your kids to school or pass a homeless person on the street. Or, you know, see an elderly lady walking down a sidewalk or, you know, stopping at a gas station. Whatever you do, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, don't forget. When you look at the person next to you, we are all Americans. We are all people. We don't need to treat each other that way. We need to use common sense. We need to stop fighting one another. We need to stop, in this country, building walls against each other. Because we are one family. We are the United States of America, right? I hope. I hope we still are. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with me on the Sarah Carter Show. We are taking the story back, America. And if you'd like, follow me on Twitter @SarahCarterDC. God bless you.